Right here, he said. We looked down and, to our disbelief, saw a row of cracked bricks. This is where the entrance to the manor used to be, the guide said, adding, It was very big. We began to fan out in the forest as rain started to fall again, looking for signs of the great Galvao farm. Over here, Paolo cried. He was 100 feet away, standing by a crumbling brick wall nestled in vines. The farm had been consumed by jungle in just a few decades, and I wondered how actual ancient ruins could possibly survive in such a hostile environment. For the first time, I had some sense of how it might be possible for the remnants of a civilization simply to disappear. When we returned to the road, the sun had begun to set. In our excitement, we had lost track of the time. We hadn't eaten since 5:30 in the morning and had nothing in the truck except a warm bottle of water and some crackers. Earlier in the trip, we had devoured my packets of freeze-dried food, Paolo saying, Astronauts really eat this stuff? As we drove through the night, lightning flashed in the distance, illuminating the emptiness around us. Taukane eventually nodded off, and Paolo and I became engaged in what had become our favorite diversion, trying to imagine what had happened to Fawcett and his party after they left Dead Horse Camp. I can see them starving to death, Paolo, who seemed focused on his own hunger, said. Very slowly and very painfully. Paolo and I were not alone in trying to conjure a denouement to the Fawcett saga. Dozens of writers and artists had imagined an ending where none existed, like the earlier cartographers who had conceived of much of the world without ever seeing it. There were radio and stage plays about the mystery. There was the screenplay Find Colonel Fawcett, which was later the extremely loose basis for the 1941 movie Road to Zanzibar, with Bing Crosby and Bob Hope. There were comic books, including one in the Adventures of Tintin series. In the story, a missing explorer based on Fawcett rescues Tintin from a poisonous snake in the jungle. Everybody thinks you're dead, Tintin tells the explorer, who says, I've decided never to return to civilization. I'm happy here. Fawcett also continued to inspire quest novelists. In 1956, the popular Belgian adventure author Charles-Henri Duhisme, who had used the pseudonym Henry Verne, wrote Bob Moran and the Fawcett Mystery. In the novel, the hero Moran investigates the Amazon explorer's disappearance, and although he fails to reveal what happened to him, he uncovers the lost city of Z, making Fawcett's dream come true. Fawcett even appears in the 1991 novel Indiana Jones and the Seven Veils, one of a series of books written to capitalize on the success of the 1981 blockbuster movie Raiders of the Lost Ark. In the novel's convoluted plot, Indiana Jones, though insisting, I'm an archaeologist, not a private detective, sets out to find Fawcett. He uncovers fragments of Fawcett's journal from his last expedition, which says, My son, lame from a bad ankle and feverish from malaria, turned back some weeks ago, and I sent our last guide with him. God save them. I followed a river upstream. I ran out of water, and for the next 2 or 3 days, my only source of liquid was the dew I licked from leaves. How I questioned myself over and over about my decision to go on alone. I called myself a fool, an idiot, a madman. Jones locates Fawcett and discovers that the Amazon explorer has found his magical city. After the two amateur archaeologists are taken prisoner by a hostile tribe, Jones, whip in hand, and Fawcett escape by plunging into the River of Death. Paolo and I went through several more fantastical scenarios. Fawcett and his party had their bodies taken over by worms, like Murray, contracted elephantiasis, were poisoned by lethal frogs, before we both fell asleep in the car. The next morning, we drove up a small mountainside to reach Bakairi Post. It had taken Fawcett a month to get here from Cuiabá. It took us 2 days. Bakairi Post had grown, and more than 800 Indians now lived in the area. We went to the largest village, where several dozen one-story houses were organized in rows around a dusty plaza. Most of the houses were made of clay and bamboo and had thatched roofs, though some of the newer ones had concrete walls and tin roofs that clinked in the rain. The village, while still unmistakably poor, now had a well, a tractor, satellite dishes, and electricity. When we arrived, nearly all of the men, young and old, were away hunting in preparation for a ritual to celebrate the corn harvest. But Taukane said that there was someone we had to meet. He took us to a house abutting the plaza, near a row of fragrant mango trees. We entered a small room with a single electric light bulb hanging overhead and several wooden benches along the walls. Before long, a tiny, stooped woman appeared through a back door. She held a child's hand for support and moved slowly toward us, as if leaning into a strong wind. She wore a floral cotton dress and had long gray hair, which framed a face so wizened that her eyes were almost invisible. She had a wide smile, revealing a majestic set of white teeth. Taukane explained that the woman was the oldest member of the village and had seen Fawcett and his expedition come through. "She is probably the last living person to have encountered them," he said. She sat down on a chair, her bare feet hardly reaching the floor. Using Taukane and Paulo to translate from English into Portuguese and then into Bakairi, I asked her how old she was. "I don't know my exact age," she said, "but I was born around 1910. She continued, "I was just a little girl when the three outsiders came to stay in our village. I remember them because I had never seen people so white and with such long beards. My mother said, 'Look, the Christians are here.'" She said that the three explorers had set up camp inside the village's new school, which no longer exists. "It was the nicest building," she said. "We didn't know who they were, but we knew they must be important because they slept in the school." In a letter, I recalled, Jack Fawcett had mentioned sleeping in a school. She added, "I remember that they were tall, so tall, and one of them carried a funny pack. He looked like a tapir." I asked her what the village was like then. She said that by the time Fawcett and his men had arrived, everything was changing. "Brazilian military officials," she recalled, "told us we had to wear clothes, and they gave us each a new name." She added, "My real name was Comeda Bakairi, but they told me I was now Laurinda, so I became Laurinda." She recalled the widespread sickness that Fawcett had described in his letters. "Bakairi people would wake up with coughs and go to the river to clean themselves, but it didn't help," she said. After a while, Laurinda got up and stepped outside. Accompanying her, we could see, in the distance, the mountains that Jack had stared at with such wonder. "The three went in that direction," she said, "over those peaks. People said there were no white people over those mountains, but that is where they said they were going. We waited for them to come back, but they never did." I asked her if she had heard of any cities on the other side of the mountains that the Indians may have built centuries ago. She said she didn't know of any, but she pointed to the walls of her house and said that her ancestors had spoken of Bakairi houses that had been much bigger and more spectacular. "They were made of palm leaves from the buriti trees and were twice as high and so beautiful," she said. Some of the hunters returned, carrying the carcasses of deer and anteaters and boars. In the plaza, a government official was setting up a large outdoor movie screen. I was told that a documentary would be shown teaching the Bakairis the meaning of the corn harvest ritual that they were about to celebrate, which was part of their creation myth. Whereas the government had once tried to strip the Bakairis of their traditions, it was now attempting to preserve them. The old woman watched the proceedings from her doorstep. "The new generation still performs some of the old ceremonies, but they are not as rich or as beautiful," she said. "They do not care about the crafts or the dances. I try to tell them the old stories, but they are not interested. They do not understand that this is who we are." Before we said goodbye, she remembered something else about Fawcett. For years, she said, other people came from far away to ask about the missing explorers. She stared at me, her narrow eyes widening. What is it that these white people did? She asked. Why is it so important for their tribe to find them? Chapter 22. Dead or Alive. The world waited for news. Any day now may bring a cable from my husband announcing that he is safe and is returning with Jack and Raleigh, Nina Fawcett told a reporter in 1927, 2 years after the party was last heard from. Elsie Reimel, who corresponded frequently with Nina, echoed her sentiments. I believe firmly that my boy and those he is with will come back out of that wilderness. Nina, who was living in Madeira with her 16-year-old daughter, Joan, beseeched the Royal Geographical Society not to lose confidence in her husband and proudly circulated one of Jack's last letters describing his journey into the wilderness. I think it is quite interesting, as being the first experience of the kind as seen by a boy of 22, she said. Once, when Joan was competing in a long-distance swimming race in the ocean, she told Nina, Mother, I feel I must succeed, because if I succeed today, Daddy will succeed in finding what he is searching for, and if I fail, they will fail. To everyone's astonishment, she won. Brian, who was then 20 and working at the railroad company in Peru, assured his mother that there was no reason to worry. Father has got to his goal, he said, and is staying there as long as possible. By the spring of 1927, however, anxieties had become widespread. As a North American Newspaper Alliance bulletin declared, fear of Fawcett fate grows. Theories abounded over what might have happened to the explorers. Have they been killed by the warlike savages, some of them cannibals? One newspaper asked. Did they perish in the rapids, or have they starved to death in this all but foodless region? A popular theory was that the explorers were being held hostage by a tribe, a relatively common practice. Several decades later, when Brazilian authorities approached the Chucahame tribe for the first time, they found half a dozen white captives. In September 1927, Roger Courteville, a French engineer, announced that while traveling near the source of the Paraguay River, in Mato Grosso, he had discovered Fawcett and his companions living not as hostages, but as hermits. Explorer called dupe of jungle sorcery. Fawcett forgetting world in paradise of birds, wild cattle, and game, the Washington Post reported. Though some sympathized with Fawcett's apparent desire to escape from a mechanical age and from dank subway platforms and sunless tenements, as one American newspaper editorial put it, others alleged that the explorer had perpetrated one of the greatest hoaxes in history. Brian Fawcett, who had rushed to meet with Courteville, thought he described Daddy exactly. Yet, with each new telling, Courteville changed both his story and the spelling of his own name, and Nina ferociously defended Fawcett's reputation. I was boiling over with indignation at the slur cast on my husband's honor, she wrote to the RGS, and informed Courteville, as the story grew and changed, there came an element of evil and malice into it. But thank God I, Fawcett's wife, saw the discrepancies of the published statements. By the time she had finished her campaign against the Frenchmen, almost no one placed any credence in him or his story. Still, the question remained. Where were Fawcett and his young companions? Nina was confident that her husband, having survived for years in the jungle, was alive. But, like Elsie Reimel, she realized now that something terrible must have happened to the expedition, most likely that the men had been kidnapped by Indians. One cannot tell what hopelessness and despair might do with those boys, Nina said. Just as her concerns were mounting, a tall, impeccably dressed man appeared at her doorstep in Madeira. It was Fawcett's longtime rival, Dr. Alexander Hamilton Rice. He had come to console her and assured her that even if the expedition had been taken hostage, Fawcett would find a way to escape. The one person you need not worry about in the jungle is the colonel, Dr. Rice said. Nina had so far resisted sending a rescue team, insisting that Fawcett and her son would rather die than have others lose their lives. But now, in her growing panic, she asked the doctor if he would be willing to go. No better man could be selected to lead such an expedition, she later said. To the shock of many of his colleagues, however, Dr. Rice decided to retire from exploring. Perhaps at the age of 50, he felt too old, especially after seeing what had happened to his seemingly invulnerable rival. Perhaps Dr. Rice's wife, who had lost her first husband and son in a tragic accident, prevailed upon him not to go back. Or perhaps he simply felt that he had accomplished everything he could as an explorer. The Royal Geographical Society, meanwhile, declared in 1927 that "we hold ourselves in readiness to help any competent and well-accredited search party." Though the Society warned that if Fawcett could not penetrate and push through, much less can anyone else, it was deluged with hundreds of letters from volunteers. One wrote, "I am 36 years of age, practically malaria-proof, stand 5 feet 11 inches, in my socks, and am as hard as nails." Another said, "I am prepared to sacrifice all, including my life." A few volunteers sought to escape a dreary home life. "My wife and I have decided that separation for a couple of years will do us both worlds of good." Some hope to attain fame and fortune, like Henry Morton Stanley, who had located Livingston 5 decades earlier. Others were simply drawn to the heroic nature of the quest, to see, as one put it, whether there is the making of a man in me or just clay. A young Welshman, who offered to enlist with his friends, wrote, "We consider that there is a greater measure of heroism in this quiet adventure than, for example, in Lindbergh's spectacular triumph." In February 1928, George Millard Dyett, a 45-year-old member of the Royal Geographical Society, launched the first major rescue effort. Born in New York, his father was British and his mother American, he had test-piloted airplanes not long after the Wright brothers and was among the first ever to fly at night. After serving as a squadron commander during World War I, he had given up flying to become an explorer, and though he did not quite fit the image of a rugged adventurer, he was 5'7" and weighed only 140 pounds, he had trekked across the Andes more than a half dozen times and ventured through parts of the Amazon. He had navigated the River of Doubt to confirm Teddy Roosevelt's once disputed claims. He had also been held captive for several weeks by an Amazonian tribe that shrank its enemies' heads. For the media, Fawcett's disappearance had only contributed to what one writer called a romantic story which builds newspaper empires, and few were as adept at keeping the story ablaze as Dyett. A former managing director of a company called Travel Films, he was one of the earliest explorers to bring along motion picture cameras, and he knew instinctively how to strike a pose and talk like a character in a B-movie. The North American Newspaper Alliance sponsored his rescue effort, which it advertised as "an adventure that makes the blood race, romance, mystery, and peril." Despite protests from the RGS that the publicity was threatening the expedition's objective, Dyett planned to file daily dispatches with a shortwave radio and to film his journey. To succeed, Dyett, who had once met Fawcett, claimed that he would need the intuition of Sherlock Holmes and the skill of a big-game hunter. He pictured Fawcett and his companions camped in some remote corner of the primeval forest, unable to come or go. Their reserve food supply must long since have been exhausted, their clothing torn to shreds or rotted to pieces. In such a prolonged hand-to-hand combat with the wilderness, Dyett added, it was only Fawcett's supreme courage that will have held his party together and instilled in them the will to live. Like Fawcett, Dyett had developed over the years his own idiosyncratic methods of exploring. He believed, for instance, that diminutive men, men that is to say, built like himself, were best able to endure in the jungle. A big man has to exert so much energy to carry his bulk that he has no surplus, Dyett told reporters, and he would be difficult to stow in a canoe. Dyett posted an advertisement in several American newspapers seeking a volunteer who was small, spare, of wiry build. The Los Angeles Times broadcast his appeal under the headline, "Diet Needs Young Unmarried Man for Perilous Jungle Trip in Search for Scientist. Applicant Must Be Single, Quiet, and Youthful." Within days, he received offers from 20,000 people. "They have come from all over the world," Diet told reporters. "England, Ireland, France, Germany, Holland, Belgium, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Peru, Mexico, all are represented. Letters have come from Alaska, too." He noted, "There are applicants in all ranks of society. There are letters from lawyers, physicians, real estate dealers, steeplejacks, from Chicago, an acrobat wrote, and a wrestler." Diet hired three secretaries to help him sift through the applications. The Independent, an American weekly newspaper, marveled, "Perhaps if there were a sufficient number of jungles available and enough expeditions to go around, we would see the spectacle of our whole population marching off in search of lost explorers, ancient civilizations, and something which it vaguely felt was missing in its life." Nina told the RGS that the outpouring was a great compliment to the enduring reputation of Colonel Fawcett. One of those who applied to join the expedition was Roger Rimmel, Raleigh's brother, who was now 30 years old. "I am most anxious, naturally," he informed Diet, "and do consider I am as entitled to go as much as anyone." Elsie Rimmel was so desperate to find Raleigh that she consented, saying, "I know of no greater help I can give them than to offer the services of my one remaining son." Diet, however, not wanting to take someone with so little experience, politely declined. Several adventurous ladies also applied, but Diet said, "I can't take a woman." In the end, he chose four hardened outdoorsmen who could operate a wireless radio and a movie camera in the jungle. Diet had strictly enforced a ban on married men, insisting that they were accustomed to creature comforts and always thinking about their wives. But on the eve of the party's departure from New York, he violated his own edict and married a woman nearly half his age, Persis Stevens Wright, whom the newspapers portrayed as a Long Island society girl. The couple planned to honeymoon during the expedition's voyage to Rio. New York City's mayor, Jimmy Walker, who came to bid the expedition farewell, told Diet that his bride's consent to his risking his life in order to save the lives of others was a display of unselfish courage of which the whole nation should be proud. On February 18, 1928, in the midst of a blizzard, Diet and his party drove to the same piers in Hoboken, New Jersey, where Fawcett had departed with Jack and Raleigh 3 years earlier. Diet's group was preparing to board the SS Voltaire when an anxious middle-aged woman appeared, bundled against the storm. It was Elsie Rimmel. She had flown from California to meet with Diet, whose expedition, she said, fills me with new hope and courage. She handed him a small package, a present for her son Raleigh. During the voyage to Brazil, the ship's crew dubbed the explorers the Knights of the Round Table. A banquet was held in their honor, and special menus were printed that listed each of the explorers by nicknames, such as King Arthur and Sir Galahad. The ship's purser declared, "On behalf of your noble band of knights, allow me to wish you cheerio, good luck, and Godspeed." After the Voltaire reached Rio, Diet bade his wife farewell and headed with his men to the frontier. There, he recruited a small army of Brazilian helpers and Indian guides, and the party soon grew to 26 members and required 74 oxen and mules to transport more than 3 tons of food and gear. A reporter later described the party as a Cecil B. DeMille safari. Brazilians began to refer to it as the Suicide Club. In June, the expedition arrived at Bacairi Post, where a group of Kayapos had recently attacked and killed several inhabitants. Diet described the outpost as the dregs of civilization mixing with the scum of the wilds. While camping there, Diet made what he considered a breakthrough. He met an Indian named Bernardino, who said that he had served as Fawcett's guide down the Curicevo River, one of the headwaters of the Xingu. In exchange for gifts, Bernardino agreed to lead Diet as far as he had taken Fawcett's party, and shortly after they departed, Diet spotted Y-shaped marks carved into the trunks of trees, a possible sign of Fawcett's former presence. Fawcett's trail loomed largely before us, and, like a pack of hounds on the scent, we were in full cry, Diet wrote. At night, Diet sent his dispatches over the radio, and they were often passed on to Nana by the Radio Relay League, a network of amateur operators in the United States. Each new item was trumpeted in international bulletins. Diet nearing jungle ordeal. Diet picks up Fawcett trail. Diet finds new clue. John J. Whitehead, a member of the expedition, wrote in his diary, "How different would the story of Stanley and Livingston been written if they had possessed radio?" Many people around the world tuned in, mesmerized. "I first heard of the expedition on my crystal set when I was only 11 years old," Lauren McIntyre, an American who went on to become an acclaimed Amazon explorer himself, later recalled. Listeners vicariously faced the sudden terrors that confronted the party. One night, Diet reported, "We came across tracks in the soft ground, tracks of human feet. We stopped and examined them. There must have been 30 or 40 persons in a single band. After a few moments, one of our Bakairi Indians turned and said in an expressionless voice, 'Kayapos.'" After trekking nearly a month northward from Bakairi Post, the party reached the settlement of the Nahuqua, one of many tribes that had sought sanctuary in the jungles around the Xingu. Diet wrote of the Nahuqua, "These new denizens of the forest were as primitive as Adam and Eve." Several in the tribe greeted Diet and his men warmly, but the chief, Aloike, seemed hostile. "He regarded us impassively with his small eyes," Diet wrote. "Cunning and cruelty lurked behind their lids." Diet was surrounded by Aloike's children, and he noticed something tied to a piece of string around the neck of one boy, a small brass plate engraved with the words W.S. Silver and Company. It was the name of the British firm that had supplied Fawcett with gear. Slipping into the chief's dark hut, Diet lit a flare. In the corner, he spied a military-style metal trunk. Without the benefit of translators, Diet tried to interrogate Aloike, using elaborate sign language. Aloike, also gesturing, seemed to suggest that the trunk was a gift. He then indicated that he had guided three white men to a neighboring territory. Diet was skeptical and urged Aloike and some of his men to take him along the same route. Aloike warned that a murderous tribe, the Suyas, lived in that direction. Each time the Nahuquas said the word Suya, they would motion to the backs of their heads, as if they were being decapitated. Diet persisted, and Aloike, in exchange for knives, agreed to guide them. That night, as Diet and his men slept among the Indians, many in the party were uneasy. "We cannot predict the actions of the Indians, for we know nothing about them except, and this is important, from these regions the Fawcett party disappeared," Whitehead wrote. He slept with a .38 Winchester and a machete under his blanket. As the expedition pushed on through the forest the following day, Diet continued to question Aloike, and before long the chief seemed to add a new element to his story. Fawcett and his men, he now intimated, had been killed by the Suyas. "Suyas! Bung, bung, bung!" the chief yelled, falling to the ground as if he were dead. Aloike's shifting explanations aroused Diet's suspicions. As he later wrote, the finger of guilt seemed to point to Aloike. At one point, as Diet was reporting his latest findings over the radio, the machine stopped working. "Jungle cry strangled," a Nana bulletin declared. "Diet radio cut off in crisis." The prolonged silence unleashed dire speculation. "I am so afraid," Diet's wife told reporters. The expedition, meanwhile, was short of food and water, and some of the men were so ill that they could barely walk. Whitehead wrote that he couldn't eat, "my fever is too bad." The cook's legs had swollen and were oozing a gangrenous pus. Diet decided to press on with only two of his men, in the hope of finding Fawcett's remains. "Remember," Diet told Whitehead. If anything happens to me, all my effects go to my wife. The night before the small contingent left, one of the men in Diet's expedition party, an Indian, reported that he had overheard Aloike plotting with tribesmen to murder Diet and steal his equipment. By then, Diet had no doubt that he had found Fawcett's killer. As a deterrent, Diet told Aloike that he now intended to take his entire party with him. The next morning, Aloike and his men had vanished. Soon afterward, scores of Indians from various tribes in the Xingu region emerged from the forest, carrying bows and arrows and demanding gifts. With every hour, a new canoe arrived with more tribesmen. Some of the Indians wore striking jewelry and had in their possession exquisite pottery, which made Diet think that Fawcett's stories of an ancient, sophisticated civilization might be true. But it was impossible to make further inquiries. As Whitehead put it, natives from tribes all over the territory, possibly 2,000 of them, gradually were hemming us in from all sides. Diet had exhausted his supply of gifts, and the Indians were growing hostile. He promised them that the next morning he would give each of them an axe and knives. After midnight, when the Indians appeared to be asleep, Diet quietly gathered his men and set out in the expedition's boats. The men pushed off and floated with the currents. No one dared to strike a paddle. A moment later, they heard a group of canoes upriver coming toward them with more Indians, apparently heading to their camp. Diet signaled to his men to pull their boats to the side of the river and lie down. The men held their breath as the Indians paddled past them. At last, Diet gave the order to row, and the explorers began to paddle furiously. One of the technicians got the wireless radio to work long enough to relay a brief message. "Am sorry to report Fawcett expedition perished at the hands of hostile Indians. Our position is critical. Can't even afford time to send full details by wireless. Must descend the Xingu without delay, or we ourselves will be caught." The expedition then dumped the radio, along with other heavy gear, to hasten its exit. Newspapers debated the team's odds. "Diet's chance to escape even," one headline ran. When Diet and his men finally emerged from the jungle, months later, sick, emaciated, bearded, mosquito-pocked, they were greeted as heroes. "We want to luxuriate in the pleasant and heady atmosphere of notoriety," said Whitehead, who was subsequently hired as a pitchman for a laxative called Nujol. "You can be sure that no matter what important equipment I have to discard, my next adventure will see me taking plenty of Nujol along." Diet published a book, Man Hunting in the Jungle, and starred in a 1933 Hollywood film about his adventures called Savage Gold. But by then, Diet's story had begun to collapse. As Brian Fawcett pointed out, it is hard to believe that his father, who was so wary of anyone knowing his path, would have left Y marks on trees. The gear that Diet found in Aloike's house may well have been a gift from Fawcett, as Aloike insisted, or it may have come from Fawcett's 1920 expedition, when he and Holt had been forced to dump much of their cargo. Indeed, Diet's case rested on his assessment of Aloike's treacherous disposition, a judgment based largely on interactions conducted in sign language and on Diet's purported expertise in Indian psychology. Years later, when missionaries and other explorers entered the region, they described Aloike and the Naukwa as generally peaceful and friendly. Diet had ignored the likelihood that Aloike's evasiveness, including his decision to flee, stemmed from his own fears of a white stranger who was leading an armed brigade. Finally, there was Bernardino. "Diet must have swallowed hook, line, and sinker what he was told," Brian Fawcett wrote. "I say this because there was no Bernardino with my father's party in 1925. According to Fawcett's last letters, he had brought with him from Bacairi Post only two Brazilian helpers, Gardinha and Simão. Not long after the expedition, Nina Fawcett released a statement declaring, "There is consequently still no proof that the three explorers are dead." Elsie Reimel insisted that she would never give up believing that her son would return. Privately, though, she was despairing. A friend wrote her a letter saying that it was natural that she was so down, but pleaded with her, "Do not lose hope." The friend assured her that the true fate of the explorers would soon be made known. On March 12, 1932, a man with brooding eyes and a dark mustache appeared outside the British Embassy in Sao Paulo, demanding to see the Consul General. He wore a sports jacket, striped tie, and baggy pants, tucked into knee-high riding boots. He said it was an urgent matter concerning Colonel Fawcett. The man was led in to see the Consul General, Arthur Abbott, who had been a friend of Fawcett's. For years, Abbott had held out faith that the explorers might materialize, but only a few weeks earlier he had destroyed his last letters from Fawcett, believing that all hope of ever seeing him again had gone. In a later sworn statement, the visitor said, "My name is Stéphane Ratin. I am a Swiss subject. I came to South America 21 years ago." He explained that nearly 5 months earlier, he and two companions had been hunting near the Tapajós River in the northwest corner of Mato Grosso when he encountered a tribe holding an elderly white man with long yellowish hair. Later, after many of the tribesmen had got drunk, Ratin said the white man, who was clad in animal skins, quietly approached him. "Are you a friend?" he asked. "Yes," Ratin replied. "I am an English colonel," he said, and he implored Ratin to go to the British consulate and tell Major Paget that he was being held captive. Abbott knew that the former British ambassador to Brazil, Sir Ralph Paget, had been a confidant of Fawcett's. Indeed, it was Paget who had lobbied the Brazilian government to fund Fawcett's 1920 expedition. These facts, Abbott noted in a letter to the Royal Geographical Society, were only known to me and a few personal friends. When Nina Fawcett and Elsie Reimel had first heard Ratin's account, they thought it sounded credible. Nina said that she dare not build my hopes too high. Still, she sent a telegram to a news outlet in Brazil saying that she was now convinced that her husband was alive. Others remained skeptical. General Rondon, after interviewing Ratin for 3 hours, noted in a report that the place the Swiss trapper indicated that he had found Fawcett was 500 miles from where the expedition was last sighted. Paget himself, when he was reached in England, wondered why Ratin would have been allowed to leave the tribe while Fawcett was forced to remain a prisoner. Abbott, however, was convinced of Ratin's sincerity, especially since he vowed to rescue Fawcett without seeking a reward. "I promised Colonel Fawcett I would bring aid and that the promise will be fulfilled," Ratin said. The Swiss trapper soon set out with two men, one of them a reporter who filed articles for the United Press Syndicate. After walking through the jungle for weeks, the three men arrived at the Arinos River, where they built canoes out of bark. In a dispatch dated May 24, 1932, as the expedition was about to enter hostile Indian territory, the reporter wrote, "Ratin is anxious to get away. He calls, 'All aboard. Here we go.'" The men were never heard from again. Not long after, a 52-year-old English actor named Albert de Winton arrived in Cuiabá, vowing to find Fawcett dead or alive. He had recently had minor roles in several Hollywood films, including King of the Wild. According to the Washington Post, Winton had given up the imitation thrills of the movies for the real ones of the jungle. Wearing a crisp safari uniform, a gun strapped to his waist, and smoking a pipe, he hurried into the wilderness. A woman from Orange, New Jersey, referring to herself as Winton's American representative, released updates to the RGS on stationery that was embossed, "Albert de Winton, Expedition into Unexplored Brazilian Jungle in Search of Colonel P.H. Fawcett." 9 months after Winton entered the jungle, he emerged with his clothes in tatters, his face shrunken. On February 4, 1934, a photograph of him appeared in newspapers with the caption, "Albert Winton, Los Angeles actor, is not made up for a role in a film drama." This is what 9 months in a South American wilderness did for him. After a brief rest in Cuiabá, where he visited a museum that had an exhibit devoted to Fawcett, Winton returned to the Xingu region. Months elapsed without any word from him. Then, in September, an Indian runner emerged from the forest with a crumpled note from Winton. It said that he had been taken prisoner by a tribe and entreated, "Please send help." Winton's daughter notified the RGS about this grave turn of events and prayed that someone at the society would save her father. But Winton, too, was never seen again. Only years later did Brazilian officials learn from Indians in the region that two members of the Camoiorá tribe had found Winton floating, naked and half-mad, in a canoe. One of the Camoiorás smashed his head in with a club, then took his rifle. Such stories did little to dissuade scores of additional explorers from trying to find Fawcett or the city of Z. There were German-led expeditions and Italian ones, and Russian ones, and Argentine ones. There was a female graduate student in anthropology from the University of California. There was an American soldier who had served with Fawcett on the Western Front. There was Peter Fleming, the brother of Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond. There was a band of Brazilian bandits. By 1934, the Brazilian government, overwhelmed by the number of search parties, had issued a decree banning them unless they received special permission. Nonetheless, explorers continued to go, with or without permission. Although no reliable statistics exist, one recent estimate put the death toll from these expeditions as high as 100. The University of California graduate student, who in 1930 was one of the first female anthropologists to venture into the region to conduct research, made it out only to die a few years later from an infection she had contracted in the Amazon. In 1939, another American anthropologist hanged himself from a tree in the jungle. He left a message that said, "The Indians are going to take my notes. They are very valuable and can be disinfected and sent to the museum. I want my family to imagine I died in an Indian village of natural causes." One seeker lost his brother to fever. "I tried to save him," he told Nina, "but unfortunately I could do nothing, and so we buried him at the edge of the Araguaia." Like Ratan and Winton, other explorers seemed to drop off the face of the earth. In 1947, according to the Reverend Jonathan Wells, a missionary in Brazil, a carrier pigeon flew out of the jungle with a note written by a 32-year-old schoolteacher from New Zealand, Hugh McCarthy, who had become fixated on finding Z. Wells said that he had met McCarthy at his Christian mission on the eastern fringe of the frontier in Mato Grosso, and had warned him that he would die if he proceeded alone into the forest. When McCarthy refused to turn back, Wells said, he gave the schoolteacher 7 carrier pigeons to deliver messages, which McCarthy placed in wicker baskets in his canoe. The first note arrived 6 weeks later. It said, "I am still quite ill from my accident, but the swelling in my leg is gradually receding. Tomorrow, I leave to continue my mission. I am told that the mountains which I seek are only 5 days away. God keep you. Hugh." After a month and a half, a second carrier reached Wells with a new message. "I am in dire circumstances," McCarthy wrote. "Long ago I abandoned my canoe and threw away my rifle, as it is impractical in the jungle. My food supply has been exhausted, and I am living on berries and wild fruits." A last trace of McCarthy was in a third note that read, "My work is over, and I die happily, knowing that my belief in Fawcett and his lost city of gold was not in vain." Nina carefully followed all of these developments in what she called the Fawcett mystery. She had transformed herself into a kind of detective, sifting through documents and poring over Fawcett's old logbooks with a magnifying glass. A visitor described her sitting in front of a map of Brazil, a pencil in her hand. Scattered about her were her husband's and son's last letters and photographs, as well as a shell necklace that Jack had sent back from Bacari Post. At her request, the RGS shared any reported sightings or rumors concerning the party's fate. "You have always taken the courageous view that you yourself can judge better than anyone the value of such evidence," an RGS official told her. Insisting that she had trained herself to remain impartial, she acted in case after case as an arbiter of any evidence. Once, after a German adventurer claimed to have seen Fawcett alive, she wrote bitterly that the man had more than one passport, at least three aliases, and a sheaf of press cuttings was found on him. Despite her efforts to remain detached, she confessed to her friend Harold Large, after rumors spread that Indians had massacred the party, "My heart is lacerated by the horrible accounts I'm obliged to read, and my imagination conjures up gruesome pictures of what might have happened. It takes all my strength of will to push these horrors out of my thoughts. The brutal wear and tear is great." Another friend of Nina's informed the Royal Geographical Society that Lady Fawcett is suffering with heart and soul. Nina discovered in her files a packet of letters that Fawcett had written to Jack and Brian when he was on his first expedition in 1907. "She gave them to Brian and Joan," she told Large, "so that they shall each and all know the real ego of the man from whom they are descended." She added, "He is much in my thoughts today, his birthday." By 1936, most people, including the Rymals, had concluded that the party had perished. Fawcett's older brother, Edward, told the RGS, "I shall act on the conviction, long held, that they died years ago." But Nina refused to accept that her husband might not be coming back, and that she had agreed to send her son to his death. "I am one of the few who believe," she said. Large referred to her as Penelope, waiting for the return of Ulysses. Like Fawcett's quest for Z, Nina's search for the missing explorers became an obsession. "The return of her husband is all that she lives for nowadays," a friend told the Consul General in Rio. Nina had almost no money except for the fraction of Fawcett's pension and a small stipend that Brian sent her from Peru. As the years wore on, she lived like a nomadic pauper, wandering with her stack of Fawcett-related papers from Brian's home in Peru to Switzerland, where Joan had settled with her husband, Jean de Monte, who was an engineer, and four children, including Rolette. The more people who doubted the explorer's perseverance, the more wildly Nina seized upon evidence to prove her case. When one of Fawcett's compasses turned up in Bakairi Post in 1933, she insisted that her husband had recently placed it there as a sign that he was alive, even though, as Brian pointed out, it was clearly something that his father had left behind before he departed. "I get the impression," Nina wrote a contact in Brazil, "that on more than one occasion, Colonel Fawcett has tried to give signs of his presence, and no one, except myself, has understood his meaning." Sometimes she signed her letters, "Believe me." In the 1930s, Nina began to receive reports from a new source. Missionaries who were pushing into the Xingu area, vowing to convert what one of them called the most primitive and unenlightened of all South American Indians. In 1937, Martha L. Monich, an American missionary, was trekking through the jungle, her eyelids swollen from ticks, and reciting the Lord's promise, "Lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world," when she claimed to make an extraordinary discovery. At the Quicuro village, she met a boy with pale skin and bright blue eyes. The tribe told her that he was the son of Jack Fawcett, who had fathered him with an Indian woman. In his dual nature, there are conspicuous traits of British reserve and of a military bearing, while on his Indian side, the sight of a bow and arrow, or a river, make him a little jungle boy, Monich later wrote. She said that she had proposed taking the boy back with her so that he could be given the opportunity not only to learn his father's language, but to live among his father's race. The tribe, however, refused to relinquish him. Other missionaries brought back similar tales of a white child in the jungle, a child who was, according to one minister, perhaps the most famous boy in the whole Xingu. In 1943, Assis Chateaubriand, a Brazilian multimillionaire who owned a conglomerate of newspapers and radio stations, dispatched one of his tabloid reporters, Edmar Morel, to find Fawcett's grandson. Months later, Morel returned with a 17-year-old boy with moon-white skin named Dulipe. He was hailed as the grandson of Colonel Percy Harrison Fawcett, or as the press called him, the White God of the Xingu. The discovery sparked an international frenzy. Dulipe, shy and nervous, was photographed in life and paraded around Brazil like a carnival attraction. A freak, as Time magazine put it. People packed into movie theaters, the lines curling around the block, to see footage of him in the wild, naked and pale. When the RGS was asked about Dulipe, it responded phlegmatically that such matters are rather outside the scientific scope of our society. Morel phoned Brian Fawcett in Peru and asked if he and Nina wanted to adopt the young man. When they examined photographs of Dulipe, however, Nina was taken aback. "Do you notice anything about the child's eyes?" she asked Brian. "They are all screwed up, as though hurt by the glare." "That child looks to me like an albino," she said. Tests later confirmed her assessment. Many legends of white Indians, in fact, stemmed from cases of albinism. In 1924, Richard O. Marsh, an American explorer who later searched for Fawcett, announced that on an expedition in Panama, he not only had spotted white Indians, but was bringing back three living specimens as proof. "They are golden-haired, blue-eyed, and white-skinned," Marsh said. "Their bodies are covered with long, downy white hair. They look like very primitive Nordic whites." After his ship landed in New York, Marsh led the three children, two startled white Indian boys, 10 and 16 years old, and a 14-year-old pale Indian girl named Marguerite, before a crush of onlookers and photographers. Scientists from around the country, from the Bureau of American Ethnology, the Museum of the American Indian, the Peabody Museum, the American Museum of Natural History, and Harvard University, soon gathered in a room at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel to see the children on display, poking and prodding their bodies. "Feel the girl's neck," one of the scientists said. Marsh surmised that they were a relic of the Paleolithic type. Afterward, the New York Times said, "Scientists declare white Indians real." The Indians were kept in a house in a rural area outside Washington, D.C., so that they could be closer to nature. Only later was it revealed conclusively that the children were, like many San Blas Indians in Panama, albinos. Dulipe's fate was tragic. Seized from his tribe and no longer a commercial attraction, he was abandoned on the streets of Cuiabá. There, the white god of the Xingu reportedly died of alcoholism. By the end of 1945, Nina, now 75 years old, was suffering from debilitating arthritis and anemia. She needed a cane, and sometimes two, to get around, and described herself as having no home, no one to help me or meet me, and crippled. Brian had earlier written her a letter saying, "You've been through enough to bust the spirit of a dozen people. But whatever you felt, you have smiled through it all and taken the rough stuff that fate has ladled out to you for such a long time in a manner that makes me feel awfully proud to be your son. You must be rather an advanced being, or the gods wouldn't have put you through such a test, and your reward will undoubtedly be very great." In 1946, when yet another account surfaced that the three explorers were alive in the Xingu, this time it was claimed that Fawcett was both a prisoner and a chief of the Indians, Nina was sure her reward had finally come. She vowed to lead an expedition to rescue them, even though it means certain death for me. The report, however, turned out to be another fabrication. As late as 1950, Nina insisted that it would not surprise her if the explorers walked through the door at any moment. Her husband, now 82, her son, 47. But in April 1951, Orlando Villas-Boas, a government official revered for his defense of the Amazonian Indians, announced that the Kalapalos had admitted that members of their tribe had killed the three explorers. What's more, Villas-Boas claimed that he had proof. The bones of Colonel Fawcett. Chapter 23. The Colonel's Bones. The chief of the Kalapalos will meet with us. Paolo told me, relaying a message that had been radioed in from the jungle. The negotiations, he said, would take place not far from the Bakari Post in Kanarana, a small frontier town on the southern border of the Xingu National Park. When we arrived that evening, the city was in the midst of a dengue fever epidemic, and many of the phone lines were down. It was also Kanarana's 25th anniversary, and the city was celebrating with fireworks, which sounded like sporadic gunshots. In the early 1980s, the Brazilian government, as part of its continuing colonization of Indian territories, had sent in planes filled with cowboys, many of German descent, to settle the remote area. Though the town was desolate, the main roads were bafflingly wide, as if they were superhighways. Only when I saw a photograph of a guest parking his airplane in front of a local hotel did I understand the reason. For years, the city had been so inaccessible that the streets doubled as runways. Even today, I was told, it was possible for a plane to land in the middle of the road, and in the main square sat a passenger airplane, the town's only apparent monument. The Kalapalo chief, Vajuvi, showed up at our hotel accompanied by two men. He had a tanned, deeply lined face and appeared to be in his late 40s. Like his two companions, he was about 5'6", with muscular arms. His hair was trimmed in a traditional bowl cut high above the ears. In the Xingu region, tribesmen often dispensed with clothes. But for this visit to the city, Vajuvi wore a cotton V-neck shirt and sun-bleached jeans that hung loosely around his hips. After we introduced ourselves and I explained why I wanted to visit the Xingu, Vajuvi asked, "Are you a member of the colonel's family?" I was accustomed to the question, though this time it seemed more loaded. The Kalapalos had been accused of killing Fawcett, an act that could require a family member to avenge his death. When I explained that I was a reporter, Vajuvi seemed accommodating. "I will tell you the truth about the bones," he said. He then added that the village wanted the sum of $5,000. I explained that I didn't have that kind of money and tried to extol the virtues of cultural exchange. One of the Kalapalos stepped toward me and said, "The spirits told me that you were coming and that you are rich." Another Kalapalo added, "I've seen pictures of your cities. You have too many cars. You should give us a car." One of the Indians left the hotel and returned moments later with three more Kalapalos. Every few minutes, another Kalapalo appeared, and the room was soon crowded with more than a dozen men, some old, some young, all of them surrounding Paolo and me. "Where are they coming from?" I asked Paolo. "I don't know," he said. Vajuvi let the other men argue and haggle. As the negotiations continued, many of the Kalapalos grew hostile. They pressed against me and called me a liar. Finally, Vajuvi stood and said, "You talk to your chief in the United States, and then we'll talk again in a few hours." He walked out of the room, the members of his tribe following him. "Do not worry," Paolo said. "They are pushing and we are pushing back. This is the way it happens." Dispirited, I went up to my room. 2 hours later, Paolo called on the hotel phone. "Please come downstairs," he said. "I think I reach an agreement for us." Vajuvi and the other Kalapalos were standing at the entryway. Paolo told me that Vajuvi had agreed to take us into Xingu National Park if we paid for transportation and for several hundred dollars worth of supplies. I shook the chief's hand, and before I knew it, his men were patting me on the shoulders, asking about my family, as if we were meeting for the first time. "Now we talk and eat," Vajuvi said. "All is good." The next day, we prepared to leave. To reach one of the largest headwaters of the Xingu, the Kuluene River, we needed an even more powerful truck, and so after lunch we said farewell to our driver, who seemed relieved to be going home. "I hope you find this why you are looking for," he said. After he departed, we rented a flatbed truck with tractor-sized wheels. As word spread that a truck was heading into the Xingu, Indians emerged from all quarters, carrying children and bundles of goods, hurrying to climb on board. Every time the truck seemed full, another person squeezed on. And as the afternoon rains poured down, we began our journey. According to the map, the Kuluene was only 60 miles away. But the road was worse than any that Paolo and I had traveled. Pools of water reached as high as the floorboards, and at times the truck, with all its weight, tipped perilously to one side. We drove no faster than 15 miles an hour, sometimes coming to a halt, reversing, then pressing forward again. The forests had been denuded here as well. Some areas had recently been burned, and I could see the remnants of trees scattered for miles, their blackened limbs reaching into the open sky. Finally, as we neared the river, the forest began to reveal itself. Trees gradually closed around us, their branches forming a net that covered the windshield. There was a constant clattering as the wood drummed against the sides of the truck. The driver flicked on the headlights, which bobbed over the terrain. After 5 hours, we reached a wire fence, the boundary of Xingu National Park. Vajuvi said that it was only half a mile to the river, and then we would travel by boat to the Kalapalo village. Yet the truck soon got stuck in the mud, forcing us to remove our equipment temporarily to lighten the weight, and by the time we reached the river, it was pitch black under the canopy of trees. Vajuvi said that we would have to wait to cross. "It's too dangerous," he said. "The river is filled with logs and branches. We must not disrespect it." Mosquitoes pricked my skin, and macaws and cicadas chanted. Above our heads, some creatures howled. "Do not worry," Paolo said. "They are only monkeys." We walked a bit farther and arrived at a shack. Vajuvi pushed the door, which creaked as it opened. He led us inside and fumbled around until he lit a candle, which revealed a small room with a corrugated tin roof and a mud floor. There was a wooden pole in the middle of the room, and Vajuvi helped Paolo and me string our hammocks. Though my clothes were still damp with sweat and mud from the journey, I lay down, trying to shield my face from the mosquitoes. After a while, the candle went out, and I swung gently in the darkness, listening to the murmurings of cicadas and the cawing of monkeys. I fell into a light sleep, but woke suddenly when I felt something by my ear. I opened my eyes with a start. 5 naked boys, carrying bows and arrows, were staring at me. When they saw me move, they laughed and ran off. I sat up. Paolo and Vajuvi were standing around a wood fire, boiling water. "What time is it?" I asked. 5:30, Paolo said. He handed me some crackers and a tin cup filled with coffee. "It's still a long way," he said. "You must eat something." After a quick breakfast, we walked outside, and in the light of day, I could see that we were at a small encampment overlooking the Kuluane River. On the shore were 2 flat-bottom aluminum boats, into which we loaded our gear. Each boat was about 12 feet long and had an outboard motor, an invention that had been introduced into the Xingu only in recent years. Paolo and I climbed into one boat with a Kalapalo guide, while Vajuvi and his family traveled in another. Both boats sped upriver, side by side. Farther north were rapids and waterfalls, but here the water was a calm olive-green expanse. Trees lined the banks, their boughs bent like old men, their leaves skimming the surface of the water. After several hours, we docked our boats along the shore. Vajuvi told us to gather our gear, and we followed him up a short path. He paused and waved his hand proudly in front of him. "Kalapalo," he said. We stood at the edge of a circular plaza that was more than 100 yards in circumference and dotted with houses much like those described by the old woman at Bakairi Post. Resembling the overturned hulls of ships, they appeared to be woven, rather than constructed, out of leaves and wood. Their exteriors were covered with thatch, except for a door in the back and the front, both low enough, I was told, to keep out evil spirits. Several dozen people were walking across the plaza. Many of them were unclothed, and some had adorned their bodies with exquisite ornamentations. Monkey-tooth necklaces, swirls of black pigment from the genipap fruit, and swaths of red pigment from the uruku berry. Women between the ages of 13 and 50 wore loose cotton dresses, the upper half dangling around their waists. Most of the men who weren't naked had on spandex bathing suits, as if they were Olympic swimmers. Physical fitness was clearly a prized trait. Some of the babies, I noticed, had strips of cloth pulled tightly around their calves and biceps, like tourniquets, to accentuate their muscles. For us, it is a sign of beauty, Vajuvi said. The tribe continued to commit infanticide against those who seemed unnatural or bewitched, although the practice was less common than previously. Vajuvi led me into his house, a cavernous space filled with smoke from a wood-burning fire.